I said, I think at one time, that I thought there was no age, there was no period that in the world's life where man had taken himself so seriously and at the same time been so ready to throw in the sponge for man as now. There was never any time before that there was any talk about man leaving the planet or his day on the planet being over like the day of the dinosaurs. But you have voices like that now, just at the time, just at the moment when man's technical triumph is unparalleled, when man ought to be so confident that he can meet every exigency, because he's met so many of them, just at this point of his great triumph, he's about to quit. He'd give up on himself. And the mood is here. It may not surface all the time, but it's here. That life is too much for us. It's gotten out of control, and we'll never be able to pull it back into control. That we're caught, as I said earlier in one period, that we're caught in a canoe, we've lost our paddle. We hear the cataract ahead, the roar, and what are we going to do? There's really nothing to do. You're going to go over the cataract. So the existentialists, in a sense, say we've got one last chance to rescue our humanity. We will not be flung over or carried over. We will leap over. So that at the last moment, just before the canoe careens over or goes over, you stand up and jump over. You have defied the powers. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. I am the invictus one. There is that mood, but it's a desperate mood. What it does is really to accept. Accept nothingness, or accept, I suppose you'd call it the nihilists, that nothing adds up, and you might as well, instead of cowering before that, you might just as well plunge into it and have a great time with nothing, accepting nothing, a kind of Dionysian plunge into meaninglessness. And there are people who, I think, who do that, and there are people who feel like doing it at times, and there's that motif in all of us. So I think it's an important time to reassess what man is. Now, in the evolutionary motif, which we've lived with now for a century or more, the idea that things gradually changed and evolved from the primitive to the more advanced, and from the simple to the complex, you're caught there with a continuity, that there's a continuum between the amoeba and me, and therefore the amoeba and me are, and I are much alike, or the chimpanzee, which is the cousin that's been used mostly to identify me. So the accent has been not on how different I am, but how much alike I am with my lower cousins. And when the biologist or whoever wants to classify us, the human being, in some category of nature, obviously it's the animal kingdom that seems to lie closest. You wouldn't say that we're a new kind of stone, or a different sort of water. We don't belong in those categories. We belong with the animals, so we are mammals. We are a type, we are part of the organic life, and we are more specifically mammals in the animal kingdom. Now, if we start with that, then I think that there are four subclasses, or four specific descriptions, that man is primarily an eating animal, or he's primarily a fighting animal, or he's primarily a mating animal, or he's primarily a thinking animal. And if you want to know what makes a man tick, why people do what they do, and what's the profoundest thing about them, the most elemental cry or need they have, then you choose one of these four, or I suppose you end up with a mixture, but one of them, after all, is kind of dominant. And we'll look at each one. First, that man is an eating animal. That is, he's a, for a more sophisticated term, he's an economic creature. Economics is the basic study, if you want to study what makes him tick. And Karl Marx would probably be the great prophet of that school. The assumption is that the most elemental need a person has is to eat. And it's a pretty good assumption. Somebody has said, a nation is only 36 hours away from revolution. Keep people from having food for 36 hours, and you would have revolution on your hands. That man wants, above all else, a dinner pail full. Give him a full dinner pail, and assure him that he's going to have a full dinner pail the rest of his life. Give him security, and he'll behave. But take that away from him, and he'll be a very bad egg to deal with. So security is the important thing. On this assumption, you'd say that civilizations move on their stomachs, just like armies move on their stomachs. If there isn't food, the army won't move. If there isn't food, the arts won't develop. So food is the major problem. That wars are fought for economic reasons, and primarily. There may be some subsidiary ones, but for economic reasons. Security gets defined in an odd absurdum at times, of course. Not only does a person want food in his dinner pail, but he wants everything else. If a person sets out to have security, we in the United States, after all, have never really known what it was to be hungry for 36 hours because we had to be. So we don't quite understand the elemental thrust of this. I suppose if we were in India or Bangladesh or in Africa along the Sahara, we'd know that this is the elemental drive. Now, when we talk about security, which is in the same category, that I want food, I want sustenance, we really run riot at that point. We finally decide that in addition to food, the basic needs are a lot of other things, like television and radio and running water and baths every day You know, we've got a whole bag now of what constitutes the basic needs for life. And I have a friend of mine who says that in my circles, he's got some money. He isn't terribly rich, but he said most of my friends feel that they have to have at least $250,000 salted away before they can retire, so they can do some of the things they've always done. And if they get to that point, they very likely start setting up trust funds for their children, or particularly grandchildren. And so they want to, they feel the need to provide security, not only for themselves until they die, but for the generations that come. And there's no stopping it. Give us this day our daily bread. when a person goes on a binge for security. And it's a very hard one. Even we who don't have much money, we know what it is to worry about tomorrow and to try to shore up this business called security. And the basic, the very foundation need is food. A person might want to go to a restaurant in a nice car, and he might want to have with him a charming companion. And when he gets there, he wants soft lights and soft and good music, and he'd like to have good silver and good china, you know, all of that. But give him all that, but don't put anything on his plate, and he'll be a bad actor. He came for the steak, after all. And man is like that. This classification would say, if you want to understand what makes him tick, look at him as an eating animal, a person who wants security. The second answer, that man is essentially a fighting animal. He's a political creature. He's not satisfied to survive. He wants to be the fittest of those who survive. He wants to excel. He wants power. He wants prestige. He wants popularity. He wants acceptance. These are his basic needs. And he'll give up a lot of eating if he can have these. He could be an ascetic, not care much for anything else but to be preeminent. The Stalin and Hitler were, you'd have to say, on the ascetic side. I don't think either one of them cared about money. And I suppose Mr. Nixon, for all his troubles with money, that this wasn't the primary thing that drove him. It was this possession of power. And power drives people mad. And absolute power drives them absolutely mad. But this school of thought would say that we are competitive creatures, basically. We want to excel, or we want more than the others. And that in our society, it happens that money is oftentimes the measure of a person's power, of a person's prestige, and his worth. And therefore, a person is bothered no end, even if he's got money enough. Let's say two people are in the same profession, and one is making $50,000. And that's enough to buy food for him. But he's bothered no end by a person in the same profession down the hallway who's making 75. And that bothers him. Not because it touches his security at all, but because it touches his prestige. And we're all in our own arena. We're all competitors. I have no trouble, for instance, applauding or cheering a football halfback on a Saturday afternoon, because I'm not in competition with him. But let somebody say to me that I think the preacher that came, Reverend Jones that just came to town, I think he must be the best preacher who ever hit this town. And I have a very hard time applauding that. I've been around for 3 years, and I don't respond very happily to that. I think it's important for everybody to have some, we're human enough to want some place where we excel, where we're a little better than others. It shouldn't be necessary, but we are human. If you can't excel in tennis or volleyball, maybe ping pong. Or if not ping pong, checkers, something where you're a little better than others. We had a friend who had polio, and his legs were not so good anymore, but he developed a good upper part of his torso, and he always wanted to do this with people. You know, he'd say, let's try this. And he always won. And it was just fun because he could take his incompetence in tennis and all of that stuff because he could beat them all in this. And I think everybody needs a little of that. But if it goes too far, what it means is that you are essentially a competitor and therefore a rival and therefore an enemy or a foe. You will use your brothers and sisters to step on, to get somewhere. The temptation is there. Now, this answer would say that wars are not economic wars. Wars are always fought for fear of losing face. To lose face is far more important, far more disastrous, that a man will go to court and exhaust his resources to prove to that lousy guy that I'm right. And I respond to this one saying that what governs our foreign policy? Is it economics? Well, I suppose a good deal of it. But it seems to me that it's always this business of getting out with honor. You know, we're going to not lose face. And that every little incident in the world, we are faced with the fact, how are we going to respond to that incident without losing face? Not without losing commerce, but without losing face. It's a horrible thing that that this becomes so overwhelming a consideration that you don't dare to lose face personally or nationally. And I suppose that's true of all the people and nations who have faces to lose. Now, some of these small countries figure, well, we haven't got much to fight for anyway. But it's a delightful thing when a person doesn't need this prestige. I think one of the delightful instances, Pastor Agrimson, who's our district president, told about when he was a pastor in Tioga, North Dakota. They discovered oil out there. And a farmer who had a little plot of ground. It wasn't worth anything. I don't suppose he had to pay taxes on it. He was a poor man anyway. They struck oil, and he became a rich man. And one day he said to Agrimson, he said, you know, it's kind of funny. Before, when I wasn't rich and important, nobody asked me for my opinion on anything. Now, you know, they ask me about everything. What do you think of Leonardo. What do you think of atomic energy? What do you think of? He wasn't using all these things, but you know, the wildest things that he would have no. And then he said, and you know, I'm just as dumb now as I was before. But suddenly he became important. Money was in our circles. Money is the sign of power and wisdom and all of such things. And some of us have enjoyed this kind of aura. I would say the lawyers and the doctors and the preachers have had kind of an inside track on some of this. And in the earlier days, when the preacher in the community was the only guy who knew any Hebrew or Greek, his opinions, he felt at least, that his opinions ought to be consulted on everything. Because he excelled in one thing, namely the classical languages. Most of his parishioners probably were smarter than he, had more common sense, more basic intelligence, but he had this esoteric area where they hadn't penetrated. the doctors, I think at the moment, are ahead of the preachers. Maybe ahead of the lawyers too. But each of us has his own language. I think the doctor is a little more mysterious than the language of the lawyer and the preacher. And they have a little of the inside track, and so you might be asking the doctor what he thinks of Leonardo, because he happens to cut you up and find strange things in you. Well, it's a lot of fun to see how we behave at this point. And we aggrandize prestige wherever we can, whether it's phony or not. But it's a profound drive. And when you ask what makes a man tick, what makes the animal tick, you can't forget his competitive makeup, and that he wants to be preeminent. He wants to win. He's a born competitor. And we exalt that, we extol that quality, particularly in our society. We say he's made it. Great. The third one, that he's not primarily an eating animal, nor a fighting animal. He is a mating animal. Sex is the elemental drive. And here old Mr. Freud will have to be given credit for getting us going. That everything a person does or doesn't do is kind of a sublimation of the sex drive. His life is in his glands, that's where it is. And if you study man's behavior, just remember that everything he does is a sublimation of this basic drive. I remember during World War II, reading an article in Liberty magazine. I don't know if the magazine is still alive or not, but the subject was Hitler. And the point of the article was that Hitler had an irregular sex life, or sex structure, or whatever. And had he had a proper sex life, been happily married, let's say, he would have been a nice guy, and we would have had no World War II. So that the wars are a result of sex, and sex gone distorted. Well, we've got plenty of prophets, and the purveyors of this answer are many. Just look at the bookstores, certain bookstores, not this one. But I have to tell you that there's one of these bookstores, these pornographic bookstores down on Fifth. Where is it, Nora? Fifth Street? You know better than I. Well, anyway, Nora was over in the public library, and that's not far away, and I was waiting for her. So I thought, I'll go in the bookstore and see what they got. Well, I got halfway down, you know, examining books, and discovered that the whole blasted supply was at the same time. So I made the round and came to the door to go out, and a rather swarthy clerk came over to me, and he said, "Sir, didn't you find what you wanted?" And I said, "No, I guess not." And I was about to go in, and he said, "I think we've got something you'd like." He was going to give me the good treatment. This old duffer needed stronger stuff. Well, anyway, this preoccupation with sex, while it's had its good points, has had some very damaging byproducts. It's thrown that drive, or that splendid quality, that's thrown it out of out of whack and distorted its position. And some of the books, somebody said, well, pretty soon nobody's going to be interested in sex because it's most of the books now are just kind of a lesson in mechanical engineering. All the mystery is gone. And I read a certain article which said we're just going to be so fed up with this that it's going to emasculate us. Nobody's going to be interested in it anymore, and the race is going to die out for want of some sex interest. And he was serious about that too. Well, anyway, what it's done is to zero in on the sex act almost exclusively, without the broader implication of sex. And it has tended to demean all other interpersonal relations but the sex act. And I don't mean love. I mean this, as if marriage is nothing more than a successful performance in bed. And if you don't succeed there, you might as well get to the divorce court fast, because that's the heart of the situation. And this tends, outside of marriage and in marriage, tends to have people use each other. That sex the sex need is like hunger, like need for food. Well, obviously, it's got some of the same qualities, but you can eat alone. You can't have the sex act in a sense alone, unless you know masturbation. But making it so central to interpersonal relations, let's say, it's practically destroyed the beauty of a friendship. Because there's a suspicion abroad that if two people, two men or two women, are good friends, that a relationship can't be important unless there's sex. So homosexuality and lesbianism and all of that stuff has kind of destroyed the implications of it, has destroyed something wonderful. And people who choose not to marry or don't marry, whether they choose or not, but let's say priests and nuns and a great number of other people whose life is so full, and it's never been a compelling thing to get married at all costs, that these people are regarded as kind of strange in society. And that's utterly wrong. And just a pity, but that's what has happened when you say that sex is the thing above all else that makes a person tick. The fourth one is in a different class, that he's a thinking animal. I guess we have run out of prophets. Nobody needs to fear that one much anymore. In the age of the Enlightenment, where reason was exalted, and where I think it was Horace Mann who said, if everybody could read or write, if everybody were intelligent, had education, we could close the prisons. The idea that man is a reasoning animal, and if you can reason with him, he'll behave. And now we've given up those prophets. We've given up that pretty much, and we say that reason is always used as kind of a veneer for gut things, deep, primitive passions that really control us. And in a rather so-called civilized society, we'll have to have an ear for that. We'll have to reason, find reasons.
so-called civilized society, we'll have an ear for that. We'll have to read, find reason. So I guess you'd have to say that this is not a very threatening thing anymore. Now, having said all that, and let me say that despite this demeaning of reason, it still is God's, I was going to say, God's greatest gift to us. I don't think it's quite that. I think the gift is freedom. How you choose having intelligence is a great gift. When you added all this up, we would be ridiculous to say, well, we are Christians and we have none of these drives. They are there, powerfully there for all of us. And there are drives that are given to us by God. I think even this competitiveness is certainly not all wrong. And it's done great things for society and great things for people. So when you put them all together, you say, yes, that's me. That's me. More or less, each one of them is me. That's man. But there is an answer that hasn't been given. That man, in addition to being all this, happens to be a child of God. And that gives him another dimension. Not just an animal with these drives, he is a child of God. And that all these drives have a trans value, or a transforming, each one gets transformed in a measure when they are drawn into Christ. After all, we use the language, or the Bible uses language, and Mary, the other night, used the language very sharply, that we are in Christ. It isn't just the Holy Spirit brings us to him, but into him. And Christ is in us, and we are in Christ. And Christ came down to this earth and became man, and in a sense became the world. Became a part of us, or became the world, put on flesh, and then arose again, came down and down and down and joined us, and then he arose again. He went up, and in going up, he took mankind, or man, and the world with him. We got to remember that the incarnation has all kinds of motifs, and that's one of them. And it makes a huge difference when you think of that Christ has taken mankind or humanity, what it means to be human, and really what it means to be the world, and taken it with him. And then I want to examine just briefly what that does to these desires that we have. Okay, with food. What is food? Food is to keep me alive, right? Now, in this new kingdom, where the world now has, where Christ has taken the world, the food is the tool, the medium, or the tool we use to love each other. That makes a huge difference. I remember LWS convention in 52 in Hanover, when Bishop Berggrav of Norway, a very salty guy, very, very wonderful person, got up and said the big problem for the world in the next years, maybe centuries, is what do you do? How do you minister to people who are produced by the welfare state, where most of the decisions are made for them? Will be. He said the church will have to hold out where it's right to do two things. One, to preach and teach, to proclaim the gospel. Secondly, to do deeds of love. Now, if the state wants to take it all over, we have to resist that. Because we are in this kingdom We are to love one another, and how do you love one another in the abstract? You love one another with tools and food. That is the elemental needs of people. And you can broaden it to have needs that aren't quite as material. But those are the tools of love. So it isn't my security. It's our security, your security in this kingdom. So that a person gets more riled up over the invasion of his neighbor's rights or property than he does over his own. It's a strange turn. But there are people like that, and most of them, and as all of them I know, have been profoundly touched by Christ. It does something to them. Now the second one on power. If I am in Christ, and Christ is the ruler of the universe, I too share his rule. I am Lord. No. But this matter of having power, of being powerful, of sharing lordship with Christ, has a strange turn too, because he's the funniest sovereign of all. He uses his power to let everybody else have a right to it. All authority is given to me. And then he dies on a cross. He lets us claim him. Which, translated, means that everybody has a right to my skills who doesn't have them already. Now, this sounds tremendously socialistic. And I don't mean to have it be an economic system. But a student has a right to the teacher's skills or knowledge. The student who doesn't have those skills or knowledge, he has a right to them. Because the teacher, taken up in this Christ kingdom, now uses her skill and her knowledge to let everyone else who doesn't have it have a claim on it. That seems very dangerous to the system. We acknowledge she deserves a recompense. She's got to eat too. So she ought to have a salary. But she teaches in this new orientation not because she gets the salary, but because these kids need what she's got, and she's caught up in a system that says if they need them, you give them. They deserve to have them from you. I don't know how you best illustrate this. I think in medicine you can illustrate it easily that the doctor must give his skills to the person who needs it because the person needs it. Well, let's say certainly deserves a living and all of that in our economic system. Let us say that a person discovered cancer, the sure cure for cancer, and he held out and said, I won't let it go to anybody until you pay me $50 billion. It's worth that. Well, indeed, it may be worth that. But the whole world would be outraged. Just totally outraged. How can a person reason that way? And yet in small things, we're all reasoning that way. You can have what I've got if you pay me for it, even though you need it and I may not need it. But this whole matter of power now, instead of being a rival, we become brothers and sisters. Instead of having this power to sell, we have the power to give to those who need whatever faith in it we have. And it's a remarkable doesn't mean that I abhor power, skills, that I'm not eager to get it, or study hard, or whatever it is. Oh, I'm still in there pitching to have as much of it as I can possibly get, but its use now has turned around. There's been some changes about that. Now, I think in sex, there, I think to recognize where God has put it and where he has designed it for two people who fall very much in love, who are attracted deeply to each other, and who, in addition, make a lifelong commitment to each other. I've talked with people who will buy the first part of this and not the second. That the commitment is not important. It'll ride the crest of falling in love, and that's enough. It's not enough. And anybody with a serious study of marital relations and the family and the need of a human being will know that in the long run, this falling in love is sustained by a commitment. And the commitment translated in our society generally involves both the state and the church, not just some commitment made under the pine trees one moonlit night. You seek the support of both of the society and of the fellowship of the believers, the church. And it's a great thing to have some indication in the Lord from the Lord where it ought to be put, and where it's used in other places, it's like food that grows stale. It will very likely destroy friendship. You've introduced an alien element into friendship with a sex act, and you can never be friends again in the same way. In fact, not friends. I don't want to spend more time with this. We've all read things and I think thought of things. The mind taken captive in this kingdom, it is not less able to do scientific pursuit. In fact, why is it, do you think, that practically all the advances in science have been made in the so-called Christian country, the Christian part of the world? Now you can say, well, that's because it's colder up here and we think better and cold. Ah, that's a lot of hooey. The Christian religion said, in fact, that God is revealed through Christ as a loving God who created us out of love, who gave us this universe in love and told us, go ahead and explore it. It's my universe. It's not inhabited by all kinds of mischievous spirits, and it's yours to enjoy, it's yours to command, and it's yours to care for. And that to release the mind of man, so that there are times I've said the car that I drive is rather remote, but still a dividend from Jesus Christ. Well, that was the bell, wasn't it? Was it? Isn't it? Oh. Okay. I'm about through anyway. But there are other concerns for the mind, like this great statement in Paul's in Philippians, whatsoever things are true and honorable and just and pure and lovely and gracious, whatsoever things are these, if there is any to be any excellence, and there be anything worthy of praise, think on those things. And this is very much, I think, what happens in the kingdom. The power to trans- transform these common things. Now, you know, they haven't been demeaned. We haven't said it's not important to eat, or it's not important to excel, it's not important to mate, it's not important to think. We haven't said that. These are all important, tremendously important areas of the common life. And it isn't fair to say that if a person becomes a Christian, he doesn't excel in these anymore. He's no good. But that's charged at times. That's what the Marxists charge, that the faith demobilized people for any energetic participation in the common life. And there have been charges made not by the Marxists, but by very fine people who stand a little on the side of the Christian enterprise and say, it's too bad. This guy was a good guy before he became a Christian. But he's not much good anymore. He's not any, you know, he isn't quite the competitor he was in our ball club. And he's a member, and in our labor union, he's kind of dropped out. He doesn't pitch anymore. And his wife even might say he's not as good a lover anymore. It's a misunderstanding, of course, of the Christian enterprise. And when we talk about saints, we usually got some anemic guy in mind, no question. You would scarcely talk about introducing a saint as a world champion prize fighter. I want you to meet Saint Leo or something. Or as a whip in the Senate. Or, any one of these places where you've got to get in there. And people would say, well, you can't give it to him. He's a Christian, and he doesn't think these things are important anymore. He's halfway over in heaven, and you gotta know that about him. Well, that's not what the Lord intended. He intended this whole business to become even more important, and we'd be better citizens of this world, which is His, than before. Well, I think I've run out. You can pick it up now. I think you ought to go in the sunshine and think about this anyway, instead of talking.